I have never liked the parable of the talents. I've just never liked it. And perhaps some of you are sitting there saying, yeah, me too. The handling of the third slave in a NRSV or servant in the Good News, it's the same word in the Greek, and I'll be using servant throughout the sermon, but the handling of that third servant has never rested well with me. Tossing that servant into the outer darkness where there is weeping and gnashing of teeth. I have never liked it. I have questioned my whole life if this is how God treats his people. I mean, this servant was being faithful. He kept in trust what was given to him. He kept it safe for the master. And on the master's return, he gave back what did not belong to him. And we've just read this parable, and if we were to go back and to reread this parable, at no point does the master instruct the servants to invest the money. At no point does he say, go, take this money and invest it wisely until my return. We might assume that that was understood. The third servant certainly does. He says to the master, I knew that you were a harsh man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you did not scatter seed. So it is implied that the master is a shrewd, perhaps even ruthless businessman. But never did he say, take this money and invest it for me. So why is the third servant punished? Is this how God treats his people? How is this story reconciled with the rest of the gospel? Where is the grace in this message? All we have is a hard man punishing a servant who was afraid, who in the eyes of the master was lazy. I mean, my heart bleeds for this servant. I feel that the master in this story is unduly harsh to him. That he was treated unfairly for doing nothing wrong. No great crime is committed, no atrocious sin to forgive. So I can relate with this third servant. If I'm honest with myself, I empathize with the third servant because that servant reminds me of myself. And I think if we are all honest, we perhaps see a part of ourselves in that third servant. It is easy to bury our abilities, our talents, if you will, in the ground. It is the safe route. There's zero commitment involved. We just go about our daily lives as we always have. And when the master returns, we'll just show up and hope for the best. Not an inspiring thought, is it? And I don't think that that's what any of us want for ourselves. However, we take the route of the third servant because it is easier. We take the route of the third servant because we are afraid. Not of what the master might say or do. No, we are afraid of failing. We are afraid of not doing enough and perhaps falling short. We're afraid we might embarrass ourselves, that we might take on a task that is simply too big for us to accomplish. We may bite off more than we can chew. And that's why we can relate to the third servant. Of course, this doesn't remove our sense of unease with this parable. The treatment of the third servant is still problematic. His being sent to the outer darkness is unsettling. However, might I suggest to you that the outer darkness, that is where the third servant was all along? That the third servant chose the outer darkness long before the master cast him out into it? That the view the servant took of the master was formed out of his own perceptions? He allowed darkness, resentment and jealousy and fear to fill his heart. So when the master sends him out to the outer darkness, all he is doing is sending that servant back from whence he came. Now I begin to think that maybe I'm not as similar to the third servant as I did at first. But what of the master? I mean, the master deserves some consideration. The master is described as a harsh man. That's how the third servant describes him, a harsh man. The Greek word that's used here is skleros. And in this context, it means to be unyielding in behavior or attitude. In dealing with others, hard, strict, harsh, cruel, merciless. In the words of the third servant, the master was not a nice man. And the master also confirms these character traits when he says to the servant, "So you knew that I reap where I do not sow." Now many often draw the comparison of the master and with God. Yet are these the words that we associate with God? They aren't the words that I use. So should we draw a parallel in our story between the master and God? Friends, I don't believe that the master in this parable is God. And the master isn't to represent Jesus. This parable is part of a series about the kingdom of heaven. The parable of the talents is not like the kingdom of heaven. Instead, our reading links back to verse 13, which is what we read last week, the verse immediately before where we started today, where it says, "Therefore, stay alert, because you do not know the day or the hour." And then verse 14, which we read today, continues, "For it is as if a man going on a journey." So the kingdom of heaven is like a master who goes away and will one day return. The talents given to the servants are the way in which Jesus asks the question, "What are you going to do while the master is away? What are you going to do while you're waiting for the kingdom?" Jesus is speaking to his disciples here. There's no one else around. He's preparing them for a time when he isn't going to be around anymore. And he's asking them, "What are you going to do when I'm not here? What are you going to do until my return?" That's what Jesus is asking. What are you going to do until the kingdom comes? And that same question that he asks of the disciples is the same one that he asks to each and every one of us. How are you going to use your time? There's a tendency to get distracted when we read this parable, to focus intently on the talents that are given to the servants, to talk about how that money or those gifts are used. And by the way, a talent was an extraordinary amount of money. The NRSV is 5 talents, and the Good News says 5,000 coins. Well, that servant who got 5 talents, that's more money than that servant could earn in a lifetime. 1 talent was about 15 years worth of wages. And so it's easy to get hung up on the talent the servants were given. And it's easy to use that word talent in a modern context and equate it with our abilities. The mantra we hear in the church around stewardship is time, talent, and money. And now you're thinking it. Here he goes. Some of you were wondering how long it would take the new minister to start talking about money. You probably saw the reading this morning and groaned on the inside. Oh, here we go. And I thought about it. I mean, what does this parable mean to us in light of an economy which is still growing and slowly after a financial crisis that was back in 2008? I thought about what this parable means in light of those preachers who preach the prosperity gospel. You know, the ones on TV with really good suits and they all own private jets. I thought about what this parable means in relation to all those Occupy movements that were happening a few years ago. I think this parable can very easily be abused, to be taken to an extreme that I'm not sure was ever the intent. Does God give us gifts? Yes. Creation is a gift to us. All that we have is a gift from God. God protects us and God looks after us. In Jeremiah we read, "For I know the plans I have for you, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you hope and a future." And in the Psalms we read, "I lift my eyes to the hills. From where will my help come? My help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth." So yes, God certainly gives us gifts. And God certainly lends us aid. So what are the talents? What part do they play in this story? We know that Jesus was telling this story to emphasize that we do not know when the kingdom of heaven is coming, that we should be using our time wisely. And what is it we should be using our time on? Well, the talents, of course. And what of that third servant then, the wicked and lazy one? He did nothing with the talent that was given to him. He wasted his time. The other servants did well, doubling what had been given them. They were not lazy. They took risks. They had faith. But of course, I still have a problem with this parable. You see, aren't we saved by God's grace? By the sacrifice of Christ on the cross? That's the new covenant. What do I have to do anything for? I can't save myself. It's already been done for me. Which makes me wonder and ask the question, are we given talents to show of our strengths or to expose our weaknesses? Just a question I ask myself, but I don't honestly think it is either of those options. You see, friends, we are given and we use the talents that God gives us because we are in a relationship with God. Just as we use our abilities to help our spouses, parents, children, and friends, we use our gifts to help God because we are in a relationship with our Creator. And of course, we didn't create anything that is found in creation. We just take part for a while. Like a pebble that's dropped into a clear lake. Our coming and participating in creation has waves which mark our presence. But the lake remains. It doesn't go anywhere. And after we are gone, others will drop their pebbles in the lake. And where those waves meet is where we meet others in life. So part of what this parable does is to remind us to live life as Christians. And what is Christian living, you might wonder? Eugene Peterson has a suggestion for what that might look like. And again, he goes to the Greek language to explain it. See, in Greek, there are three different voices. There's the active and the passive voice, and we are familiar with those. The boy throws the ball is an example of the active. The boy was hit by the ball is the passive voice. But the Greek language also has a middle voice. And with the middle voice, the subject enters into an action that someone else started and that someone different will finish. So imagine floating down a river. You didn't make the river or cause the current to flow. And the river will continue to flow to its destination long after you get out. But in the meantime, you can jump in, you can float along, steer yourself, position yourself to avoid rocks and other obstacles. And Peterson suggests that Christian life is like that. We are saved by God's grace. But then we are given the opportunity to jump into an already flowing river of grace. And all that we do while in the river is ultimately the work of God. Our actions in the river would not be possible if it were not for God. Friends, the third servant missed all of this. The servant missed the fact that the handing of the talents was an act of grace. That everything that happened afterwards was a result of that grace. We demonstrate our understanding of that grace by living as Christians. The motivation behind the talents is not to fear that we might fail. It is not to fear that we take on too large a burden. The motivation behind the talents is the joy that comes in the knowing that we were given those gifts in the first place. It's a question of working within God's grace. Or we can be like the third servant and miss the true meaning of the talent. We can hide it away. But what value is there in that? Near the end of C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia, Aslan the lion takes Lucy, Edmund, Peter, and everyone to the new Narnia, to what would be called heaven, or the new creation. It's a place of astounding light and beauty, a place where every blade of grass seems to mean more, and where every creature sings for the sheer joy of the Creator. It is a place where everything is just so real in depth and color that the mere sight of a daisy takes your breath away and makes you weep for the sheer beauty of the thing. But then in the midst of all that splendor, the children see a group of dwarves huddled together, convinced that they are sitting in the rank stench of a barn. A place so dark that they cannot see their hands in front of their faces. And Lucy is so upset that the dwarves are not enjoying New Narnia that she begs Aslan to help them see. And Aslan replies, Dearest Lucy, I will show you what I can do and what I cannot do. Aslan then shakes his golden mane, and a sumptuous banquet instantly appears before those dwarves. And each dwarf is given a plate heaped with juicy meats and glistening vegetables, plump grains of rice. And each also receives a goblet brimming with the finest wine you could ever imagine. But when the dwarves dive in and begin eating, they start gagging and complaining. "Doesn't this beat all?" they lament. "Not only are we in this stinking stable, but now we have to eat hay and dried cow dung as well." And they sip the wine and they sputter, "Oh, look at this now, dirty water out of a donkey's trough." The dwarves, Aslan goes on to say, had chosen mistrust instead of trust and love. They were prisoners of their own minds. They could not see Aslan's gift of the new Narnia, for they would not see it. And might something be going on with the third servant in this parable? Could it just be that he could not see the goodness of his master, choosing fear and suspicion over hope and joy? And so we come full circle. We realize that we're not like that third servant at all. We recognize the goodness that God offers in creation. We embrace and cherish that gift, and we walk in fellowship with God, using those very gifts that have been bestowed upon us. How will we use our time while we wait for the Master to return? We will use that time. We will use those gifts in joyful service to God, walking hand in hand with those that we love, spreading the glory of God's creation, sharing in the grace that is God's gift to each one of us. I leave you with a quote from Bill Keane. "Yesterday is history. Tomorrow is a mystery. Today is a gift from God, which is why we call it the present." Friends, I invite you to walk with God, to enjoy the grace accorded to each of us. Work for the kingdom, knowing the grace given will expand and increase, bringing further joy into your life. Amen.